Good afternoon and welcome to the meeting of the Midcoast Forum, the February meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from Erickson Hall. Actually, now it's called Hedges Hall in Point Lookout, Northport, Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the good offices of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, who is, there's no other word for it, malingering in Florida. He is the president of the Forum. Founded in 1983, the Forum is now in its 34th year of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomatic policy. This is meeting number 396 of the Forum. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Our speaker today is New York Times journalist and Mexico specialist, Julia Preston. It's a little awkward here. We invited Julia before our president alerted us that journalists are the most dishonest human beings on the face of the earth, and that the New York Times, the failing New York Times, is a publisher of fake news, and that Mexico has recently been added to his next to be invaded list. So we invited her a long time ago, and her remarks have to be preceded with a little disclaimer, like you get on the cigarette package, that you know what you're about to hear may not merit the presidential stamp of approval. So we're going to listen politely to what she has to say, and then we'll go back and look into Breitbart News to get the straight scoop. So Julia, welcome, I guess. Julia Preston.
Well, that's quite an introduction. I'm here to attempt to recover my integrity for the Maine audience. I was invited to speak mainly about Mexican foreign relations, but we are in the midst of an extraordinary standoff over immigration between the President of the United States and the courts, and I thought that I would just bring that issue to you today so that we can have a good discussion about this crisis that's taking place right before us as we speak today, more chapters of this event falling out. So my talk is entitled Of Immigrants, Executive Orders, and the American Nation, and I'm just going to go one by one through the immigration executive orders that President Trump issued in recent days. Executive Order 1, Border Security and Immigration Enforcement Improvements. The Foreign Secretary of Mexico, Luis Videgaray, was in Washington on January 25th, pleased to be one of the first foreign diplomatic leaders to be invited by the Trump administration. He was eager to settle plans for a trip the following week for President Enrique Peña Nieto to meet with President Trump. Videgaray regarded his visit as a reward for his efforts to bring Trump to Mexico during the presidential campaign, a gesture that was so unpopular in Mexico at the time, it had cost Videgaray an earlier position in the cabinet. But with Trump's surprise victory, he looked prescient, and Peña Nieto brought him back into the government. But President Trump rewarded the Mexican Foreign Secretary that day with something else. It was an executive order mandating, and I quote, the immediate construction of a physical wall on the southern border. As he had countless times before to cheering crowds during the campaign, President Trump asserted with bravado that Mexico would pay for the wall. With his order and its timing, President Trump threw acid on a close and remarkably steady relationship with Mexico, our neighbor across a 2,000-mile border and the United States' third largest trading partner, which in recent years had been increasingly essential to the day-to-day protection of United States border security. And this is an aspect of this relationship that people haven't thought about or focused on in the discussion about trade. Trump's order provoked such outrage in Mexico that it unified the left and the right, which I can tell you is a very substantial accomplishment, and forced Peña Nieto to cancel his trip to Washington. In an address to the nation, Peña Nieto insisted again that Mexico would not pay for the wall, an idea that had seemed so absurd to Mexicans that the president had struggled to take it seriously until President Trump's order was published. The Mexican president also assured Mexican immigrants in the United States that their government would come to their defense if Trump started an onslaught of deportations. In a hastily arranged hour-long call the following day, the two presidents agreed not to argue in public about how to pay for the wall. But the new chill and unpredictability between the neighbors remains. President Trump's executive order on border security was exceptional for the degree to which it did not correspond to the realities of the Southwest border. It was a series of radically aggressive measures to fix things that were not radically broken. And the signature measure in the order, the physical wall, did not efficiently address things that could use some fixing at the Southwest border. However, the order did codify the menacing view of immigration to the United States and of a border overwhelmed by an influx of felons and terrorists that President Trump had articulated during his campaign and which contributed in no small part to his victory. It was clear evidence that President Trump would be good to his word. His administration would cast aside an optimistic narrative about immigration that had prevailed through much of the post-war era, the narrative in which immigrants are a source of renewal for the country, a source of the entrepreneurial drive, the diversity, and the innovation that sustain American growth and make us unique. Rather, for President Trump, most immigrants are illegal, and they are mainly infiltrators, likely wrongdoers. Open quote, among those who illegally enter are those who seek to harm Americans through acts of terror or criminal conduct, the executive order reads. Illegal immigration, it says, open quote, presents a clear and present danger to the United States, using rhetoric generally reserved for times of war. With his three immigration executive orders, President Trump, above all, carried through on the pledges of his campaign to the letter and with spectacular speed, regardless of whether they comported with the facts on the ground. And with the approval rating of Congress still stuck below 20%, President Trump's very consistency is heartening and reassuring to his supporters. And this is no small accomplishment given the political polarization that we have in our society today. But Trump's unabashed nativism is not new in American history. Such views swept over Congress in the turbulent early decades of the 20th century, like today, a period of global shocks. They led to laws that banned all Asians from coming to the United States and imposed national origin quotas with barely concealed racial intent to exclude people from Southern and Eastern Europe. Those laws framed four decades of American immigration and were not fully repealed until an overhaul of the system in 1965. I think we forget how recently this kind of worldview informed our immigration system. But no American president in the modern age has had such a viscerally suspicious view of immigration and such a determination to reduce it as Donald Trump. Consider the reality of the border. Today, more Mexican immigrants, both legal and illegal, are leaving the United States than arriving. The population of undocumented Mexicans peaked in 2007 at about 6.9 million and has been declining ever since. In recent years, the number of Mexicans caught crossing illegally at the Southwest border fell to about 230,000 a year, a low level not seen since the early 1970s. It's still a lot, it's still a big number, but compared to what was happening just as recently as 10 years ago, this is a much reduced flow across the border. A broad study by security experts at the Council on Foreign Relations found that border security measures had become far more effective in accomplishing the core goal, which is dissuading migrants from starting out on an illegal journey in the first place. When I started covering the immigration beat for the New York Times in 2006, there were still places along the California border where the Border Patrol was playing Red Rover. In some spots, you could stand with the Border Patrol agents at dusk on a bluff overlooking the line, and you would see the migrants lining up on the other side, waiting for nightfall to make their charge. On one of my last trips to the border, I drove through the station at Nogales, Arizona, into Mexico, to a shelter for migrants run by the Mexican government in the mountains south of the Babucovari Range. Over the years, thousands of migrants have roasted to death in the summertime ovens of that desert. But on this occasion, the saguaros were covered with an inch of snow. A group of Mexican migrants stumbled into the shelter, mute with cold shock. Wearing only windbreakers and plastic ponchos, they had spent 3 days and nights in the mountains looking for a passage where there was no border, where there were no Border Patrol agents, no drones overhead, no ground sensors, no surveillance cameras. On the fourth morning, they woke to discover that their coyote guides had fled and taken their money. One of the men, a man named Elio Leon Reyes, came into the shelter crying, heaving heavy sobs. He was broke and frozen. He said he was going back to his home in Guerrero, Mexico, and he was not coming back. Even an inexpert look at that section of the Arizona border makes it clear that those peaks and crags and crannies are no place for a physical wall. In the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, site of the surge of crossings in the past 2 years, the big river that marks the boundary curves and twists. Again, no place for a physical wall. There are places in the flatlands and on the outskirts of cities and towns where tall fencing is useful to slow illegal migrants down. But the Border Patrol has discovered that solid walls, rather than see-through fences, are the least effective barriers and the most dangerous for them, because they allow migrants on the other side to throw rocks over without agents being able to see who did it. And actually, this rock throwing is a major major danger for Border Patrol agents who work directly down at the line. Yet Senator McConnell, the majority leader, acknowledging President Trump's zeal to build his signature measure, has said that Congress will devote up to $17 billion as an initial investment in the project. Fortunately for American taxpayers, General John Kelly, the retired four-star Marine general who is the Secretary of Homeland Security, has taken a critical view of this project, saying in his confirmation hearing that, open quote, a physical barrier in and of itself will certainly not do the job. He advocated what he called a layered approach with radars and sensors, intelligence and manpower all needed. These days, border crossings are, in fact, surging again. But the people coming across are no longer Mexican laborers. They are families fleeing bloody mayhem from criminal gangs in Central America, as well as Haitians and Cubans. Many of the Central Americans are seeking asylum. And rather than running away from the Border Patrol, they are running towards border agents to ask for protection. This is obviously not a problem that can be addressed by a wall. The most serious threats these days are not likely to be trekking for days through mountain passes. Drug traffickers are tunneling under the border. They, and perhaps would-be terrorists, are using fake documents to join more than 1 million people who come every day through the ports of entry. This is where our risk is these days. The risk is not in the areas that are handled by the Border Patrol. The real risk, the place that we need to be focusing, is in the ports of entry. It's a totally different kind of security task. President Trump had strong support from the unions of the Border Patrol and customs agents. With any luck, they will work with Homeland Security leaders to come up with a cost-efficient plan to continue building on the significant security advances of the Obama administration. But General Kelly also pointed to another crucial element of security, what he calls, and I quote, good partnerships with Mexico and other countries in the hemisphere. The authorities' main battle today is not with wandering migrants, but with international criminal syndicates of traffickers and smugglers, and perhaps worse. Those are the real bad hombres. In that battle, working with Mexican law enforcement and Mexican intelligence is a crucial, though always tricky and delicate job. But the point of President Trump's order on border security was not about the details, the day-to-day details. It was largely symbolic, a message to Mexico and its people to keep out. An executive order designed to bring bold reinforcement to border security has also done damage to it. Executive Order 2, enhancing public safety in the interior of the United States. President Trump's second executive order on January 25th laid the groundwork for a vast expansion of the nation's deportation system. He has promised to swiftly deport as many as 2 million people in the early part of his term, focusing, he says, primarily on criminals. And just to put that in perspective, President Obama, who up to now holds the record for formal deportations by a Mexican president, deported slightly more than 2.5 million people in 8 years of his term. The order broadens the definition of who would be a criminal in the eyes of the Trump administration. So to accomplish these large numbers, the Trump administration is laying the groundwork through this executive order to expand the population of people who would fit into the priority of being a criminal. President Trump swept away enforcement priorities set by President Obama that brought a tight focus on criminal convicts and on recent border crossers, and encouraged agents to steer away from immigrants who did not have criminal histories, even if they did not also have legal immigration status in the United States. Now, all immigrants in the country illegally, open quote, present a significant threat to national security and public safety, the order says. Authorities can now round up immigrants charged with crimes but not convicted, and people who agents think might have been involved in, open quote, a chargeable criminal offense, close quote. Under the order, and I quote, the judgment of an immigration officer is sufficient to have an immigrant deported as a public safety risk. The judgment of an immigration officer. Trump's order revives a nationwide program called Secure Communities, which the Obama administration abandoned after it was crippled by court rulings and met fierce resistance in immigrant neighborhoods. Under that program, immigration and customs enforcement agents can issue a hold request, known as a detainer, for any undocumented immigrant booked by police, or really any foreigner booked by police, no matter whether there was a conviction or how minor the defense, the offense. The expansion of the Secure Communities program led to record numbers of formal deportations under President Obama. What President Trump's order means is that stepped up deportations will soon be coming to a community near you. There likely will be raids at factories and other workplaces which we have not seen since the last years of the Bush administration. In northern Maine, there may be Border Patrol highway checkpoints and searches on trains. Immigrant families across the state and the country are newly fearful, retreating from community life. Based on this order, they have good reason to be afraid. The order, with its threat to withdraw federal funding for cities the administration identifies as sanctuaries for undocumented immigrants, has divided law enforcement agencies. And this is interesting. This does not have the universal support of law enforcement. Many sheriffs who run county jails do support this mandate from the Trump administration to reconsolidate the relationship between local law enforcement and federal authorities. But city and town police chiefs, including in Maine, are wary. By and large, most police departments already are willing to help immigration and customs enforcement when they have foreign criminals in custody. But we don't believe immigration enforcement should be forced on local police, said J. Thomas Major, the chief of Montgomery County, Maryland, who is also president of the Major City Chiefs Association. Chief Major said city chiefs hope to persuade President Trump that closer cooperation with ICE would erode vital trust in their officers among immigrants, which is essential to the daily task of catching and prosecuting criminals and protecting witnesses. In Lake County, Illinois, for example, which is home to many Latino immigrants, the sheriff there, whose name is Mark Curran, was more blunt. Those of us who live in the real world where there are lots of Latinos in our counties would not go anywhere near a program like that, Sheriff Curran said. Executive Order number 3, this was on January 27th, and this is the one that is causing such a stir today. It's called Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States. With a stroke of a pen, President Trump suspended all immigration for 90 days from 7 Muslim-majority countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. He suspended all refugee admissions for 120 days, and he banned Syrian refugees indefinitely. Amazingly, White House officials appear to have been surprised that the travel ban has caused a furor and confusion and protests at airports in the United States and around the world. Several courts quickly stepped in to delay aspects of the ban. And this is, there have been so many courts that have weighed in on this in recent days that it's been really hard to follow. I tried to make a list of all the rulings, but it really has gone very quickly in Boston, New York, in Virginia, but the most broad injunction came late last week from an even-mannered Republican appointee in the Federal District Court in Seattle, Judge James Robart. The judge halted the central elements of the program based on Washington State's claim of broad damage to its universities, its businesses, its families, and the freedom to travel of its residents. Amid the uproar, with protests proliferating across the country, two questions could be asked. First, why target the refugee program? And second, if better and deeper vetting was the goal, and that, in my view, is a worthy goal, that's a good goal, we should have better vetting, why not conduct a review and impose new procedures without the shock and tumult of a travel ban? Of all the ways to enter the United States, the refugee program is probably the last channel a terrorist would choose. Two analysts at the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan research group, recently composed a useful litany to summarize the hurdles that refugees must pass, vetting by, and I quote, 8 U.S. government agencies, 6 different security bases, 5 separate background checks, 4 biometric security checks, 3 separate in-person interviews, and 2 interagency security reviews. And you can imagine that the Partridge is also undergoing a security check as part of this process. It's a process that typically takes as long as 2 years. Recently, as many as 25% of the refugees who were admitted to the United States were children, as we have seen in recent days with families greeting refugees who made it through the travel ban, and they were greeted with toys and balloons at the airport. Before now, the United States has been the leading country resettling refugees, a significant source of its moral authority and political influence on humanitarian issues. The message of closing our doors to Syrian refugees in the wake of the slaughter by the Assad regime and its Russian allies in the city of Aleppo, as the world looked on day after day in helpless horror, has arguably done unquantifiable damage to our standing among the very allies who are most important to us in the fight against elusive terrorist enemies. Also unproductive is the stunning decision to include Iraq on the list of the countries in the immigration ban. Never mind the long and troubled history of relationships that the American military has fought to build and to maintain to support the government in Iraq, which American troops have died for. Iraqi troops with assistance from Americans are on the front lines today, pushing ISIS back out of its aspirational caliphate in the country. Now, countless Iraqis who have dared over the years to support the American effort cannot even board a plane to fly to our country for a visit. The confrontation in the courts is about the president's authority under immigration law. Indeed, it is a set of laws that give the chief executive exceptionally broad powers to determine who can enter the United States. And the Trump administration is on pretty secure legal ground with some aspects of this executive order. This is a body of law that really is almost unequaled in our statutes in terms of the discretion that the president can exercise in that particular issue of who can come in or not come into the United States. At the same time, other statutes prohibit discrimination in immigration by race, by religion, or significantly by country of origin. So we have a situation where he singled out these seven countries, and that would appear to conflict with another aspect of the immigration code. Eventually, the courts will determine which of these legal provisions will dominate. For now, the states of Washington and Minnesota have challenged President Trump with a broad statement of purpose, saying they choose to be welcoming to immigrants and refugees. So the argument, the reason that this has become such a significant argument is because of the nature of the claim that Washington made. They have really argued a whole philosophy of the state and a whole way of conduct that the state likes to conduct its immigration business has been challenged by this presidential executive order without any authority from Congress. President Trump has responded with a tweet that, as is his style, does not necessarily represent security realities, but succinctly summarizes his view of the world. What is our country coming to when a judge can halt a Homeland Security travel ban and anyone, even with bad intentions, can come to the United States? I think that's a very succinct view, a very succinct statement by the president of what it is that is driving his actions in this case. Judge Robart concluded that the states are likely to face irreparable harm if the order attacking the refugee and immigration system goes forward. The court concludes, he said in his ruling, that the circumstances brought before it today as such are such that it must intervene to fulfill its role in our tripartite government. That's where we're at today. Standoff is continuing. All right.
Well, thank you, Julia. That was sobering. Not to say I'm endorsing any of it, of course. And you forgot to mention that Judge Robart is a so-called judge. I think that was one of the tweets established that. Why has the anti-Mexican rhetoric seemed to go down so well with so many people?
One of the interesting things about the patterns of the voting patterns and the response to President Trump's campaign was that the places that were most enthusiastic about the anti-immigration rhetoric and proposals were the places that had the fewest number of immigrants. And so I think partly there's a phenomenon where people have not had direct experiences either in the workplace or in their communities with Mexican immigrants, so they are more inclined to believe or suspect that, you know, Mexican laborers could be undercutting wages in a given situation, that there could be rampant use of public services by undocumented Mexicans, which is generally not the case. There's quite a bit of evidence that this is not the case. So I think partly it has to do with a lack of direct experience, a direct personal experience. But I also think that there have been situations where the fact that we do have a large population of 11 million undocumented people in the country, in some situations, construction industry in particular, there has been what could be considered disloyal competition from these workers. And it really stands to reason if you have a population out there that does not enjoy its full rights under law, which is the case of undocumented people, that there will be a temptation for them to low bid and make it complicated for American contractors who have to operate with a higher cost level because they're employing people who have been in the business for many years and aren't American citizens and have higher needs. So I do think that is a little bit part of it. What can I tell you? I mean, the history of Mexican-American people and Mexican immigrants in the United States is really almost as dramatic from the perspective of discriminatory and racist conduct as the history of African-American people. And it's a history that we know much less about than we do about our African-American history. But so in some ways, it's not surprising. I mean, there is also, this has been part of our history. And what President Trump has done is also revived many of those sentiments, I think, in different parts of the country.
A wall 10 feet high or more presently exists along portions of California and Arizona. I think that's on the books at something like $7 billion, I read somewhere. This fact is missing from coverage on the wall. How effective has the existing wall been?
I said in my comments that there are places where these physical barriers have been very useful. And they are in cities. For example, I mean, many of you may have seen the pictures of Nogales, where there's these hills and there's a fence that goes across the top of it. So what that does is, in an urban environment, one of the big problems that the Border Patrol has is that somebody who does manage to get across the fence can sort of vanish into the parking lots and the malls, you know, very quickly. And in those specific situations where you have urban infrastructure, where you have on both sides of the border, dense population, then those structures can be very useful. Almost none of it is what you would call a wall, however. Border Patrol, in recent years, what they call rocking, did become a serious security issue, a danger issue, a harm issue for Border Patrol agents because they had these barriers that were solid, and they couldn't see through them either. They were solid in the sense that they're big fences, but they had some kind of canvas or some material on them that made it so you couldn't see through. And the result was that the smugglers, when they were wanting to get people across, they would start throwing rocks over, and the Border Patrol couldn't see who was doing it. And so in Nogales, for example, and some of those other border towns in southern Arizona, they actually took down those barriers and replaced them with fences where you can see through, and that was substantially diminished the problem of the rocking.
How many non-Mexicans cross the southern border? And is there any evidence that ISIS is attempting to send its soldiers through Mexico?
In the last 2 years, the Mexicans are no longer, for the first time in almost a century, I believe, the majority population of illegal border crossers. So you have people from Central America is the largest group that's surging. These are mainly families, as I spoke about in my comments. These are, by and large, asylum seekers. They are coming to the border and asking for protection and triggering a whole legal process that takes place in our system for people who request asylum protection.
Maybe the question should have been, how many non-Latins are crossing the border?
The numbers are very small. Very small, although you have, in recent days, you have had this very substantial influx of Cubans who were trying to get in before President Obama did what he did in the last days of his term, which is close down this sort of privileged access that you had for Cubans for many years since the revolution. And otherwise, you see Chinese people. But the number of people, for example, from the Middle East is so small that almost every time that it happens, that a person from the Middle East is apprehended, it becomes news in some community. So the numbers are, in fact, very qual- in terms of illegal border crossers. Again, what I would emphasize is that I think the more significant risk is people who devise fake documents or create vehicles or, you know, focus on getting in through the ports of entry. And that's a problem that needs to be addressed by intelligence and by sophisticated training of the agents of Customs and Border Protection. And in fact, in the executive order, there is no increase of funding for Customs and Border Protection. This is a separate agency from the Border Patrol. It's not the same group of people who do this. And I have to tell you that the CBP people are really remarkably skilled. They sit there all day long watching people come through in their cars, and they can really sense. They're so well trained that somebody, you know, just from a look in the eye, they're just incredibly good at figuring out who needs to be sent to secondary inspection. And they need a lot more help, a lot more intelligence. They need better training. You know, this is something that we should be focusing on.
Since you mentioned funding, doesn't this all come to a key point when Congress gets to weigh in on funding any of it? $17 billion for wall construction. Is there a chance that that's going to, is that going to get through a Republican Congress?
You know, like anything else, it depends on how the president handles it. Senator McConnell has said that Congress is going to take up an appropriation for up to $17 billion for the, specifically for the construction of the wall and other border infrastructure. And whether or not, my view is that there is broad support among Republicans for enhanced border enforcement. And so whether or not that, you know, this will become, you know, in the budget process, that the funds will be steered away from this improbable project to put cement structures on top of mountains and into some more practical than that, right? I mean, it was very interesting to hear General Kelly at his confirmation hearing. He's quite a remarkable guy, I think, General Kelly. At his confirmation hearing, right out of the gate, Senator McCain asked him, what do you think about the border wall? And he said, it's not going to do the trick by itself. I mean, right there it was, right in his confirmation hearing. So I think before he became the Secretary of Homeland Security, General Kelly was the commander in Southcom, in the Southern Command, which is the military structure for the Southern Hemisphere, for Latin America. And he was involved in a lot of the negotiations and policy making over the problem in Central America, and he understands very well how deep the problem is of the criminal gangs that have really taken control of at least two societies in Central America, in El Salvador and Honduras. They're really, the extent of the criminal gang structure is such that they really are in a sort of contesting state power in those countries. And I think General Kelly understands that that's not a problem that you can deal with by building a physical wall at the border. And so I think he may have an interesting influence on bringing some sense into this, what we all hope will not become a major boondoggle by the Republican Congress.
We have friends in Spain who say they'd love to have our immigration problem. Their immigration problem is people coming across from the Arab countries. And in Spain, more than half of the jail population is made up of Arab immigrants, Arab illegal immigrants. What about the Mexicans, their history, the illegal, how many of them are in jail or have committed criminal acts?
I wouldn't be able to tell you a number of that. I would be, having served as the bureau chief and, I'm sorry, as the correspondent in Mexico for 6 years for the New York Times, I would be the last person to say that there aren't serious criminals among the Mexican population. I mean, we have...
The ones coming in.
Yes, no, that's right. Is there gang violence in Los Angeles? Yes. Do we have a problem that the Mexican cartels have created a whole kind of retail infrastructure across our country and are dealing in heroin and methamphetamines and other drugs that are causing a significant epidemic in the country? Well, yeah, we do have a problem about that. But is this a majority of the Mexican immigrant population? Absolutely not. And is this a population that is supported by Mexican immigrants, by and large? Of course not. These folks are just as dangerous for Mexican immigrant communities as they are for us. And so, and in general, the picture of the immigrant population is that the crime rates among first-generation immigrants, including Mexican undocumented immigrants, is really much lower than among Native Americans. And I mean, among American Native citizens is what I'm saying. And I should maybe clarify something about that that's difficult to understand. Being an undocumented person, that is to say, being present in the United States without legal status, is not a crime. It's a civil violation. And so it's not a contradiction in terms to say that an undocumented person is not a criminal. This is, I think, something that's very hard for people to understand. The immigration code is civil code. And so just the fact that this person is present in the United States does not make them a criminal. Now, it is true that crossing the border without inspection is a federal misdemeanor. But if you haven't been convicted of the crime, you're not a criminal. I think what we're talking about here is not whether is not immigration-related offenses, but whether or not these people are then going out robbing people, you know, murdering people, creating violent crimes. The answer to that is significantly their rate of committing that kind of crime is significantly lower than among the American population in general.
Julia, you're the first journalist we've had come to speak to us since the assault by the White House on journalists. And I, as I understand, you have been until recently a bureau chief at the Times.
No, I was an immigration correspondent.
Immigration.
Yes.
Correspondent.
But that did entitle me to being part of the group of the most dishonest people that that President Trump has experienced.
What are you and your colleagues? How are you responding to this barrage of disparagement?
Well, you know, this has been a huge argument and debate in the journalism community. How do you respond to this? Do we fight back? Do we refuse to cooperate? Do we take umbrage? And I think, I can speak for myself and also, I think, for the New York Times, which is that I think we believe that the way that we conduct ourselves in this situation is to do good journalism, to do deeper reporting, to take a deep breath and just keep eyes on the goal here. The eyes on the goal is that this president he's president of the United States. For our purposes, this is not any different than President Obama. He might be doing good things, he might be doing bad things. If he's doing things that are contrary to what he said he would do, if he's doing things that are suspect under the law, if he's creating policies that are creating huge objections and turmoil in the United States, then that's a subject for our journalism. And if he has significant conflicts of business interest, which has been a place where the Times has really distinguished itself, this absolutely legitimate area for our reporting. And if we get too emotional about it and get our feelings hurt, then we're not going to do good journalism. You know, the way you do good journalism is you go to the files, you go to the record, you talk to people, you talk to as many people as you can, you try and find the person 20 years ago who had the experience that you need to hear about to make your story. You don't jump to conclusions. You don't go beyond what you have in your notebook, in your recording, what you've seen with your own eyes, and you do good journalism, and I think that's what we're gonna do.
I have two questions here that have to do with medicine. First of all, pertaining to the seven countries, might that ban mean that we have fewer general practitioners and medical people coming into the United States?
I'm not sure it would be in terms of numbers, but there are definitely, even in recent days, there have been experiences. I think there was an experience at a hospital in Boston, if I'm not mistaken. But there have been stories in recent days about medical professionals who are on their way either to medical school or to taking up assignments or to doing medical research from Iran, for example, and from Iraq, who have been kept out of the country by this ban. This is not just, this is all people, all nationals from these countries. It's an extremely extensive ban.
We have in Maine and elsewhere in the country medical marijuana industry and now recreational marijuana. Attorney General Sessions, in his hearings, refused to rule out federal enforcement of anti-marijuana laws in those states that have legal, quote, legal marijuana. What would that do to the Mexican, to the trade of marijuana? Wouldn't that be a boon for the marijuana importers?
It's an interesting question. I mean, my impression is that that Mexican marijuana exporters at this point don't need a boon beyond what they are already getting from the many Americans who live in yeah, in the states where you don't have medical marijuana or legalized marijuana. But, and let me just say something about that, which, you know, I made a little bit of a joke about it, but I can't remember what the count is among my colleagues in Mexico who've been murdered in the drug war in the last 4 or 5 years, but it's well over 24. I mean, this has been a terrible nightmare for journalism in Mexico. And so the idea that there's somehow a recreational use of drugs, be it marijuana or cocaine, the drugs that are produced in Mexico or that are coming through Mexico, the idea that somehow there's some innocent recreational use of those drugs, at least with respect to Mexico, is really wrong. This is really wrong. This business has been tearing apart the fabric of Mexican society, and particularly the journalists who've tried to cover it have just been confronted, many of them just either killed or driven out of the profession. So I would say that just as a note.
What is the United States doing to deal with the drug-related lawlessness within Mexico itself?
Well, I mean, this again goes to this question, which is that when I first started going to Mexico, which was many years ago, there was essentially no cooperation between the United States and the Mexican government on these drug issues. And there was a famous killing in the 1980s of an American drug agent who was kidnapped and killed, named Kiki Camarena, who was tortured by a Mexican cartel. And basically, the Mexican police did not come to his defense, and that was how estranged the two countries were. It's really remarkable how dramatically that has changed in recent years, so that the Mexican government increasingly sees it as a common interest with the United States, particularly in the area of intelligence, because this is something that's very difficult for the Mexican government because so many of its local police are corrupt, you know, either because they have no choice. If you have a major wealthy drug cartel in your little village, your choice is either buy in or die. The Mexican government has traditionally and today a serious difficulty in developing the kind of intelligence that you need to really fight this kind of criminal organization. And the United States has the ability to, technologically and other ways, to really help with that intelligence. And the Department of Homeland Security has a major counterterrorism and counter-narcotics center in Texas where, you know, this intelligence is being developed. And the work that they do depends very fundamentally on their ability to communicate with Mexican authorities. And so, again, I would say that this is an aspect of the confrontation with Mexico that President Trump has unleashed that I don't think people have talked enough about, which is that this is also, there's a danger here that we could really undermine very important security relations that have been developed with that country in the last few years.
This question seems a little glib, but I think it's dead serious. Is there a Craigslist for coyotes? We hear so many times about the coyotes that take the money and really don't do anything. Wouldn't that technological solution help?
Well, so one of the things that happened this is quite recent, I would say 5 years or so, which is that the drug cartels have been warring in northern Mexico. And as part of that war, they expanded into the human smuggling business. So there is no more the possibility of getting some nice guy from your village to, you know, who's been back and forth to the United States to take you up there. What happens now is any migrant who's trying to get into the United States is passing through a gauntlet of very, very dangerous criminal organizations to get to the border. And there have been times still, even recently, where on a day where when I'm going into Mexico to Reynosa, for example, to do some reporting and figure out what it looks like from that side of the border, you have to take full security precautions. You can't be there for a whole day. I and my photographer, we have to go in one car, switch to another car. This is just to go to the migrant shelter, because border towns are so entirely wired by these very aggressive drug cartels that you can't even move around there without somebody finding out about it. This is part of the problem. This is not a problem that's going to be solved by a wall. This is a problem that needs to be addressed by very sophisticated and focused law enforcement and international intelligence capabilities. So that's where I think we're at with that problem.
One thing Americans can do to help Mexico is to go there. You say the border is very unsettled, but how about the rest of Mexico, Mexico City and the coastal towns?
It varies, and I think you can get good information about what parts of the country are not safe and what parts of the country are safe. I have a family member who just had a fabulous trip through central Mexico, what they call the Bajío, Guanajuato, Zacatecas. These are extraordinarily beautiful, historic gold mining towns and fabulous, and it's safe. You know, and there are many parts of Mexico where you can go and have a wonderful time, and there are other parts of Mexico where you shouldn't go. And so it's like probably any other trip that you would make these days, which is you need to find out ahead of time what's going on.
Say a word about the sanctuary cities and churches, the effectiveness of that program.
So there are actually two different references there. The idea of sanctuary city is actually a little bit of a misnomer in most cases. The most prominent actual self-declared sanctuary city is San Francisco. And this dates actually from not recent times, but from the times of the wars in Central America, where San Francisco became a city that welcomed El Salvadorans and Guatemalans and people who were fleeing from a time from Central America at a time when there was a very prominent and aggressive United States presence and intervention in that part of the world. And so they couldn't always get status right away, immigration status, and so the churches and the city took them in and have continued that tradition. More recently, what the sanctuary title refers to is cities that have somehow limited their cooperation between the local police and federal immigration authorities. And in most cases, across the country, the word sanctuary is not accurate. In other words, as I said in my talk, almost every case, local police departments are willing to cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to the extent that they will, if asked, they will report who is in their local jails, who they have in custody, and they will inform ICE when that person is going to be released so that ICE can come and pick that person up if they think it's necessary. The federal courts have ruled in recent years that local police cannot hold a person in their custody after that person has finished whatever local charge is keeping them in custody. The police cannot hold that person based on a request from federal immigration authorities for any period of time. The federal courts have determined that you need a warrant to hold somebody in custody in the United States. You'll be glad to know. So that decision has frayed the relationship between the local police and federal immigration authorities, because the courts have said you can't just hang on to this person while you're waiting for immigration agents to come around. The immigration agents have to get there and pick that person up if that's what they want to do. And so that's what the fight is about right now, is whether or not the Trump administration is now going to mandate or somehow force local police to get back into the business of immigration enforcement, which is something that most police departments are reluctant to do and have been withdrawing from over the last few years.
If NAFTA is renegotiated, might there be some win-win changes possible?
Oh, I think so. I mean, absolutely. NAFTA's how old is it? It went into effect in 1994. It's a 22-year-old agreement. I mean, NAFTA was one of the earliest, a good faith renegotiation between that included Canada, the United States, and Mexico could, I think, significantly improve the protections for displaced workers in all of the country. I mean, NAFTA is quite weak in terms of the protections and the retraining, the benefits that it provides or encourages for workers who are displaced as a result of trade under its terms. And any trade treaty, you're going to get displacement. This is going to happen. It also happened in Mexico, by the way. For example, the sugar industry in Mexico was massively decimated by NAFTA. There could be provisions that would also provide retraining and relocation for Mexican workers. There are a lot of things that could happen. But if you start out with a hostile attitude, I think, we'll see if it makes it more difficult.
Workers that are necessary for food production in California, Arizona, and elsewhere.
Well, those seasonal workers, the last time I saw a figure on this, farm labor force in the United States is over half undocumented workers. It could be a much higher percentage than that. The United States is just not raising kids who want to do farm work. And in fact, farm work has been done by immigrants for very long time. And now we've created a situation where what used to be a kind of cyclical process where people used to, especially Mexicans, they would come up, they would do farm work in California and around the country, and then they would go home. Now they can't go home because they can't get back in. So they're all staying in this country. And so the farm labor force has really swelled with undocumented people. So the answer is that it has the potential that some of this expansion of the deportation system really has the potential to really decimate the farm labor force in the United States.
On that cheerful note, thank you, Julia.